July, Sunday, 2nd of July, 7:45 a.m. Mum just rang.
Oh, hello, darling.
Guess what? I'll just take the phone in the other room. Hang on, I said, glancing over nervously at Daniel, who was asleep, unplugging the phone and creeping next door.
Una and Geoffrey are having a Tarts and Vickers party in the garden on the 29th of July. Don't you think that's fun? Tarts and Vickers, imagine!
I tried hard not to, fighting off a vision of Una Alconbury in thigh boots, fishnet tights and a peephole bra. For 60-year-olds to organise such an event seemed unnatural and wrong.
Anyway, we thought it would be super if you and...
Coy loaded pause.
Daniel could come. We're all dying to meet him.
I don't think it's really Daniel's... But she wasn't listening.
Mark Darcy's going to be there, apparently, with someone, so... What's going on?
Daniel was standing stark naked in the doorway.
Who are you talking to?
My mother, I said desperately out of the corner of my mouth.
Give it to me, he said, taking the phone.
I like it when he is authoritative without being cross like this.
Mrs. Jones, he said in his most charming voice. It's Daniel here.
I could directly hear her going all fluttery.
This is very bright and early on a Sunday morning for a phone call. Yes, it's an absolutely beautiful day. What can we do for you? Well, that would be lovely. I shall put that in the diary for the 29th and look out my dog collar. Now, we'd better get back and catch up on our sleep. Cheerio, he said firmly and put the phone down.
Saturday, 22nd of July. Actually, I'm really excited about Daniel coming to the Tarts and Vickers party with me next Saturday. 2 a.m. Woke up in floods of tears from a hideous dream I keep having where I'm sitting A-level French and realise as soon as I turn the paper over that I have forgotten to do any revision. And I'm wearing nothing except my domestic science apron, trying desperately to pull it round me so Miss Shignall won't see that I'm wearing no pants. I expected Daniel to be at least sympathetic. I know it's all to do with my worries about where my career is leading me, but he just lit himself a cigarette and asked me to run over the bit about the domestic science apron again.
It's all right for you with your bloody Cambridge first, I whispered, sniffing.
I'll never forget the moment when I looked at the notice board and saw a D next to French, and I knew I couldn't go to Manchester. It altered the course of my whole life.
You should thank your lucky stars, Bridge, he said, lying on his back and blowing smoke at the ceiling. You'd probably have married some crashing Geoffrey Boycott character and spent the rest of your life cleaning out the whippet cage.
Anyway, he started laughing, there's nothing wrong with a degree from... He was so amused now, he could hardly speak.
Bangor. Right, that's it. I'm sleeping on the sofa, I yelled, jumping out of bed.
Hey, don't be like that, Bridge, he said, pulling me back. You know I think you're an intellectual giant. You just need to learn how to interpret dreams.
What's the dream telling me, then? I said sulkily. That I haven't fulfilled my potential intellectually?
Not exactly.
What then?
Well, I think the pantless apron is a pretty obvious symbol, isn't it?
What?
It means that the vain pursuit of an intellectual life is getting in the way of your true purpose.
Which is what?
Well, to cook all my meals for me, of course, darling, he said, beside himself at his own amusingness again, and walk around my flat with no pants on.
2 p.m. Cannot believe what has happened. By 1 p.m., Daniel had still not woken up, and I was starting to worry because the party starts at 2:30.
Eventually, I woke him with a cup of coffee and said,
"We're supposed to be there at 2:30.
"Were," he said,
"the Tarts and Vickers.
Oh, God, love, listen, I've just realised I've got so much work to do this weekend. I'm really going to have to stay at home and get down to it."
I couldn't believe it. He promised to come.
10 p.m. Cannot believe what I have been through. I arrived at the Alconbury's house and, hoping I looked okay in the bunny girl outfit I had selected, walked round the side to the garden, where I could hear voices raised in merriment.
As I started to cross the lawn, they all went quiet, and I realised to my horror that instead of tarts and Vickers, the ladies were in country casual style calf-length floral two-pieces, and the men were in slacks and V-neck sweaters. While everyone stared, Una Alconbury came flapping across the lawn in pleated fuchsia, holding out a plastic tumbler full of bits of apple and leaves. "Bridget, super to see you. Have a pims," she said. "I thought it was supposed to be a Tarts and Vickers party," I hissed. "Oh, dear, didn't Geoffrey call you?" she said. I couldn't believe this. I mean, did she think I dressed as a bunny girl normally or something? "We're all looking forward to meeting your new boyfriend," she said, looking round. "Where is he?" "He had to work," I muttered. "How's my little Bridget?" said Uncle Geoffrey, lurching over, pissed.
"Geoffrey,"
hissed Una.
"Go and see to the barbecue."
"I'm sorry, darling. You see, we decided after all the scandals there have been with Vickers around here, there would be no point having a Tarts and Vickers party because..." She started to laugh. "Because everyone thought Vickers were tarts anyway." "Oh, dear," she said, wiping her eyes. "Anyway, how's this new chap, then? What's he doing working on a Saturday? Oh, how are we going to get you married off at this rate?" "At this rate, I'm going to end up as a call girl," I muttered, trying to unpin the bunny tail from my bottom. I could feel someone's eyes on me and looked up to see Mark Darcy staring fixedly at the bunny tail. Beside him was the tall, thin, glamorous top family law barrister, clad in a demure lilac dress and coat like Jackie O, with sunglasses on her head. The smug witch smirked at Mark and blatantly looked me up and down in a most impolite manner. "Have you come from another party?" she breathed. "Actually, I'm just on my way to work," I said, at which Mark Darcy half-smiled and looked away. Una, looking purposeful, hurried across to me. "Bridget, I'm so sorry about the mix-up over the fancy dress," she said. "Would you like to borrow something?" I spent the rest of the party wearing, over my suspender outfit, a puff-sleeved floral sprig Laura Ashley bridesmaid dress of Janine's, with Mark Darcy's Natasha smirking. "I don't think much of the girlfriend, do you?" said Una Alconbury loudly, nodding in Natasha's direction as soon as she got me alone. "Oh, hello, Mark. Another glass of Pimm's? What a shame Bridget couldn't bring her boyfriend. He's a lucky chap, isn't he?" All this was said very aggressively, as if Una was taking as a personal insult the fact that Mark had chosen a girlfriend who was, A, not me, and B, had not been introduced to him by Una at a turkey curry buffet. "What's his name, Bridget? Daniel, is it? Pam says he's one of these super-duper young publishers." "Daniel Cleaver," said Mark Darcy. "Yes, it is, actually," I said, jutting my chin out. "Is he a friend of yours, Mark?" said Una. "Absolutely not," he said abruptly. "Oh, I hope he's good enough for our little Bridget," she pressed on. I think I could say again, with total confidence, "Absolutely not," said Mark. "Oh, hang on a tick, there's Audrey. Audrey!" said Una, not listening and tripping off, thank God. "I suppose you think that's clever," I said furiously when she'd gone. "What?" said Mark, looking surprised. "I suppose you think it's all right to slag people's boyfriends off to their parents' friends behind their backs, when they're not even there, for no reason, just because you're jealous," I flailed. "Sorry," he said. I was just trying to figure out what you mean. Have I... Are you suggesting that I'm jealous of Daniel Cleaver? Over you?" "No, not over me," I said, furious, because I realised it did sound like that. "I was just assuming you must have some reason to be so horrible about my boyfriend other than pure malevolence." "Just take care of yourself, that's all," he said quietly. After 45 minutes more horror, I thought I could decently leave, pleading work to Una. By the time I got back to London, I was feeling pretty shaky. And I was back much earlier than I expected, so I thought, instead of going straight home, I'd go round to Daniel's for a bit of reassurance. There was no answer when I rang. So I left it a while and rang again, in case it was just in the middle of a really good wicket or something. Still no answer. I knew he must be around because his car was there, and he'd said he was going to be working and watching the cricket. I looked up at his window, and there was Daniel. I beamed at him, waved, and pointed at the door. He disappeared, I assumed, to press the buzzer, so I rang the bell again. He took a bit of time to answer. "Hi, Bridge. Just on the phone to America. Can I meet you in the pub in 10 minutes? "Okay," I said cheerfully, without thinking, and set off towards the corner. But when I looked round, there he was again. Not on the phone, but watching me out of the window. Cunning as a fox, I pretended not to see and kept walking. But inside I was in turmoil. Why was he watching? Why didn't he just press the buzzer and let me come up straight away? Suddenly it hit me like a thunderbolt. He was with a woman. My heart pounding, I rounded the corner. Then, keeping flat against the wall, I peered round to check he had gone from the window. No sign of him. I hurried back and assumed a crouching position in the porch next to his, observing his doorway between the pillars in case a woman came out. But then I started to think, what was to stop him leaving the woman in the flat, with instructions to stay there until he had time to get to the pub? I looked at my watch. 6:30. Ha! The pub wasn't open yet. Perfect excuse! Emboldened, I hurried back towards the door and pushed the buzzer. "Bridget, is that you again?" he snapped. "The pub isn't open yet." There was silence. Did I hear a voice in the background? In denial, I told myself he was just laundering money or dealing in drugs. He was probably trying to hide polythene bags full of cocaine under the floorboards, helped by some smooth South American men with ponytails. "Press the buzzer, Daniel," I said. Isn't it funny how you can detect someone's presence, even though you can't see, hear, or otherwise discern them? But I knew there was a woman in Daniel's house. We stood there, warily, at opposite sides of the sitting room. "What have you got on?" he said. I had forgotten about Janine's outfit in the excitement. "A bridesmaid's dress," I said haughtily. "Would you like a drink?" said Daniel. I thought fast. I needed to get him into the kitchen so I could go through all the cupboards. "A cup of tea, please." "Are you all right?" he said. "Yes, fine," I trilled. "Marvellous time at the party. Only one dressed as a tart. Mark Darcy was there with Natasha. That's a nice shirt you're wearing." I stopped, out of breath, realizing I had turned... there was no turning about it. Into my mother. He looked at me for a moment, then set off into the kitchen, at which I quickly leapt across the room to look behind the sofa and the curtains. "What are you doing?" Daniel was standing in the doorway. "Nothing, nothing. Just thought I might have left a skirt of mine behind the sofa," I said, wildly plumping up the cushions, as if I were in a French farce. "Just on my way to the loo," I said. Daniel was staring at me as if I was mad. I locked the loo door and started frantically looking around for things. I wasn't exactly sure what, but long blonde hairs, tissues with lipstick marks on, alien hairbrushes. Any of these would have been a sign. Nothing. Next, I quietly unlocked the door, looked both ways, slipped along the corridor, pushed open the door of Daniel's bedroom, and nearly jumped out of my skin. There was someone in the room. "Bridge." It was Daniel, defensively holding a pair of jeans in front of him. "What are you doing in here?" "I heard you come in here, so I thought it was a secret assignation," I said, approaching him in what would have been a sexy way were it not for the floral sprig dress. I leaned my head on his chest and put my arms around him, trying to smell his shirt for perfume traces and get a good look at the bed, which was unmade as usual. "You still got the bunny girl outfit on underneath, haven't you?" he said, starting to unzip the bridesmaid dress and pressing against me in a way which made his intentions very clear. "Oh, the kettle must be boiling," he said suddenly, zipping my dress up again and patting me reassuringly in a way that was most unlike him. "After you," said Daniel, pushing me out and shutting the door so I had to walk ahead of him back into the kitchen. As I did so, I suddenly caught sight of the door that leads up to the roof terrace. That was where she was. She was on the bloody roof. "What's the matter with you?" he said as I stared at the door suspiciously. "Nothing," I sing-song gaily, flopping into the sitting room. "Just a little tired from the party." I flung myself casually onto the sofa. Daniel brought me a cup of tea and sat down at his laptop, which was open and turned on. Only then did I start to think that maybe there was no woman. There was a document up on the screen. Maybe he really had been working, and on the phone to America. And I was making a complete prat of myself, behaving like a madwoman. "Are you sure everything's all right, Bridge?" "Fine, yes. Why?" Now I felt a complete fool. It was bloody Mark Darcy trying to wreck my relationship by sowing suspicions in my mind. Poor Daniel. It was so unfair to doubt him in this way, because of the word of some arrogant, ill-tempered, top-flight human rights lawyer. Then I heard a scraping noise on the roof above us. "Oh, I think maybe I'm just a bit hot," I said, watching Daniel tensely. "I think maybe I'll go and sit on the roof for a while." "For God's sake, will you sit still for 2 minutes?" he yelled, moving to bar my path, but I was too quick for him. I dodged past, opened the door, ran up the stairs and opened the hatch out into the sunlight. There, spread out on a sun lounger, was a bronze, long-limbed, blonde-haired, stark, naked woman. I stood there frozen to the spot, feeling like an enormous pudding in the bridesmaid dress. The woman raised her head, lifted her sunglasses and looked at me with one eye closed. I heard Daniel coming up the stairs behind me. "Honey," said the woman in an American accent, looking over my head at him, "I thought you said she was thin." August, Tuesday the 1st of August, 5 a.m. I'm falling apart. My boyfriend is sleeping with a bronze giantess. My mother is sleeping with a Portuguese. Jeremy is sleeping with a horrible trollop. Prince Charles is sleeping with Camilla Parker Bowles. Do not know what to believe in or hold on to anymore. Oh, God, what's wrong with me? Why does nothing ever work out? Is it because I'm too fat? After rooftop encounter, I didn't say a single word to Daniel. Just put my nose in the air, slithered past him, marched down to the street into car and drove away. Went immediately to Tom's, who poured vodka straight down my throat from the bottle, adding the tomato juice and Worcester sauce afterwards. Oh, God, birds have started singing. I have to go to work in 3.5 hours. Can't do it. Help, help! I've suddenly had brainwave. Ring Mum. 10 a.m. Mum was brilliant. "Darling," she said, "I can't believe you got in a state like this over a stupid man. They're all completely self-centred, sexually incontinent, and no use to man nor beast. Yes, that does include you, Julio. Now come along, darling. Brace up. Go into work looking drop-dead gorgeous." "Oh, but Mum, I have to work with Daniel. I..." "Darling, wrong way round. He has to work with you. Give him hell, baby." "Oh, God, I don't know who she's been mixing with." "I've been thinking anyway. It's high time you got out of that silly dead-end job where no one appreciates you. Prepare to hand in your notice, kid. Yes, darling, I'm going to get you a job in television." I'm just off to work looking like Ivana Bloody Trump wearing a suit and lip gloss. Wednesday, 2nd of August. Daniel kept sending me computer messages at work. "We should talk," etc., which I studiously ignored. Tonight he caught up with me outside the office as I was leaving. "Darling, please, we really need to talk." Like a fool, I went for a drink with him to the American bar at the Savoy. Let him soften me up with champagne and... "I feel so terrible, I really miss you, blah, blah, blah." Then the second he got me to admit, "Oh, Daniel, I miss you too," He suddenly went all patronising and businesslike and said, "The thing is, Suki and I..."
"Suki?"
"Pukey, more like," I said, thinking he was about to say, "Our brother and sister, cousins, bitter enemies, or history." Instead, he looked rather cross. "Oh, I can't explain," he said huffily. "It's very special." I stared at him, astonished at the audacity of his volte-face. "I'm sorry, love," he said, taking out his credit card and starting to lean back to get the attention of the waiter. "But we're getting married." Friday, 4th of August. Office, third floor toilets. "This is just intolerable. Cannot deal with it out there. I heard Daniel on the phone arranging to meet Pukey tonight, and he said in a flopsy bunny voice, 'Not too bad, so far.' And I knew he was talking about my reaction, as if I were Sarah Bloody Keys or someone. Wednesday, 9th of August, 8 a.m. Ugh! In physically disastrous state from hangover, but emotionally very much cheered up by night out with Jude and Sharon. Jude arrived in vixen from hell fury because vile Richard had not showed up for relationship counselling. The therapist woman obviously just thought he was an imaginary boyfriend and I was a very, very sad person. "So what did you do?" I said sympathetically. She said I had to talk about the problems I had that were unrelated to Richard. "We don't have any problems that are unrelated to Richard," said Sharon. "I know. I told her that, and she said I had a problem with boundaries and charged me £55. 9 a.m. Blimey. Mum just rang. "Darling," she said, "guess what? Good afternoon, I'm looking for researchers. Current affairs. Terribly good. I've spoken to Richard Finch, the editor, and told him all about you. I said you had a degree in politics, darling. Don't worry, he'll be far too busy to check. He wants you to come in on Monday for a chat." Monday? Oh, my God. That only gives me 5 days to learn current affairs. Saturday, 12th of August. Right. Determined to be V-positive about everything. I'm going to change life. Become well-informed, re-current affairs, stop smoking entirely, and form functional relationship with adult man. 5:45 p.m. Trying to concentrate hard on memorising names of shadow cabinet. Midnight. Call Tom, who took me to a party a friend of his from art school was having at the Saatchi Gallery to stop me obsessing. "Bridget," he muttered nervously as we walked into the white hole and sea of grunge youths. "You know it's uncool to laugh at installation, don't you?" "Okay, okay," I said sulkily. "I won't make any dead fish jokes." Someone called Gav said, "Hi." 22 maybe? Sexy? In a shrunken T-shirt revealing a chopping board-like midriff. "It's really, 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 like, amazing," Gav was saying. "It's like a solid utopia with these really, really, really good echoes of, like, lost national identities." He led us excitedly across the big white space to a toilet roll, inside out with the cardboard outside the paper. They looked at me expectantly. Suddenly I knew I was going to cry. Tom was now drooling over a giant bar of soap bearing the imprint of a penis. Gav was staring at me.
"Wow, that is, like, a really, really, really wild," he whispered reverently as I blinked back tears. "Response."
"Just going to the loo," I blurted, rushing away past a configuration of sanitary towel bags. When I came out, Tom was waiting outside. "Come and talk to Gav," he said. "He's really, like, into you." Then he took one look at my face and said, "Oh, shit, I'll take you home." It's no good. When someone leaves you, apart from missing them, apart from the fact that the whole little world you've created together collapses, and that everything you see or do reminds you of them. The worst is the thought that they tried you out, and in the end, the whole sum of parts which adds up to you got stamped reject by the one you love.
Gav likes you, said Tom. Gav is 10. Anyway, he only liked me because he thought I was crying about a toilet roll.
Well, you were in a way, said Tom.
Bloody git Daniel.
Sunday, 13th of August. The bad night. On top of everything else, tried to read myself to sleep with new issue of Tatler, only to find Mark Bloody Darcy's face smouldering out from feature on London's 50 most eligible bachelors, going on about how rich and marvellous he was. Ugh! Made me even more depressed in way cannot fathom. 6 p.m. Rang up Jude. As luck would have it, Jude had just been reading a brilliant book called Goddesses in Every Woman. Apparently, the book says that at certain times in your life, everything goes wrong, and you don't know which way to turn. And it is as if everywhere around you, stainless steel doors are clamping shut like in Star Trek. What you have to do is be a heroine and stay brave without sinking into drink or self-pity, and everything will be okay. Monday, 14th of August. Oh, God, terrified about interview. I've told Perpetua I'm at the gynaecologist. I know I should have said dentist, but opportunities to torture the nosiest woman in the world must not be allowed to slip through the net. Oh, my God. Who's the Shadow Defence Secretary? Oh, fuck. Oh, fuck. Shit. Telephone. I can't believe it. Terrifying telephonic teenager with patronising South London sing-song going, Bridget! Hello, Richard Finch's office here. Richard's in Blackpool this morning, so he won't be able to make the meeting. Rescheduled for Wednesday. Will have to pretend have recurring gynaecological condition. Wednesday, 16th of August. Instead of being ushered into the office to meet the great Richard Finch, I was left pouring sweat in reception for 40 minutes before being picked up by the sing-song personal assistant, Patchouli, who sported lycra cycle shorts and a nose stud and blanched at my jigsaw suit.
"Richard says to come to the conference, know what I'm saying?" she muttered, powering off down a corridor while I scurried after her. She burst through a pink door into a vast open-plan office strewn with piles of scripts. TV screens suspended from the ceiling, charts all over the walls, and mountain bikes propped against the desks. At the far end was a large oblong table where the meeting was in progress. A plump, middle-aged man with curly blonde hair, a denim shirt, and Christopher Biggin's spectacles was jigging up and down at the end of the table. "Come on, come on," he was saying, holding up his fist like a boxer. "I'm thinking Hugh Grant. I'm thinking Elizabeth Hurley. I'm thinking how come he gets away with it. That's it. How does a man with a girlfriend with looks like Elizabeth Hurley have a blowjob from a prostitute on a public highway and get away with it?" I couldn't believe this. What about the shadow cabinet? Suddenly he was looking straight at me. "Do you know?" The entire table of Grund's youths stared. "You! You must be Bridget," he shouted impatiently. "How does a man with a beautiful girlfriend manage to sleep with a prostitute, get found out and get away with it?" I panicked. My mind went blank. "Well," he said. "Well, come on, say something."
"Well, maybe," I said, because it was the only thing I could think of. "It was because somebody swallowed the evidence." There was a deathly hush. Then Richard Finch started to laugh.
"Bridget Jones," he said, eventually wiping his eyes. "Welcome to good afternoon. Take a seat, my darling."
And then he winked. Monday, 28th of August. A letter arrived from Richard Finch, the editor of Good Afternoon, offering me a job, I think. This is all it said.
"Okay, my darling, you're on."
10:30 a.m. office. Just called Richard Finch's assistant, Patchouli, and it is a job offer. But must start in a week. I don't know anything about television, but sod it. I'm stuck in a dead end here. And it's just too humiliating working with Daniel now. I'd better go and tell him. 11:15 a.m. I can't believe this. Daniel stared at me, ashen-faced. "You can't do this," he said. "Have you any idea how difficult the last few weeks have been for me?" Then Perpetua burst in. She must have been eavesdropping outside the door.
"Daniel!" she exploded. "You selfish, self-indulgent, manipulative, emotional blackmailer! It was you, for God's sake, who chucked her! So you can just bloody well put up with it!"
Suddenly, think I might love Perpetua, though not in a lesbian way. September. Monday, 4th of September. 8 a.m. First day at new job. Must begin as mean to go on with new, calm, authoritative image. 8:30 a.m. Mum just rang, I assume, to wish me luck for the new job.
"Guess what, darling," she began.
"What?"
"Elaine has invited you to their ruby wedding," she said, pausing breathlessly and expectantly.
My mind went blank. Elaine?
"She thought it might be nice to have one or two young'uns there to keep Mark company."
Ah, Malcolm and Elaine, begetters of the over-perfect Mark Darcy.
"Apparently he told Elaine he thought you were very attractive."
"Oh, don't lie," I muttered. "Please, though."
"Well, I'm sure that's what he meant anyway, darling."
"What did he say?" I hissed, suddenly suspicious.
"He said you were very..."
"Mother."
"Well, the word he actually used, darling, was bizarre. But that's lovely, isn't it? Bizarre. Anyway, you can ask him all about it at the Ruby wedding."
"I'm not going to celebrate the Ruby wedding of two people I have spoken to once for 8 seconds since I was 3, just to throw myself in the path of a rich divorcee who describes me as bizarre."
"Now, don't be silly, darling."
"Anyway, I've got to go," I said, foolishly, since she then, as always, began to gabble as if I were on death row, and this was our last phone call before I was given a lethal injection.
"Did I tell you I saw Mavis Enderby in the post office?"
"Mum, it's my first day at work today. I'm really nervous. I don't want to talk about Mavis Enderby."
"Oh, my godfather's darling, what are you going to wear?"
"My short black skirt and a T-shirt."
"Oh, now you're not going to go looking like a sloppy tramp in dull colours. Put something smart and bright on. What about that lovely cerise two-piece you used to wear?"
Felt so bad when she put the phone down that smoked 5 silk cut in a row. Non-VG start today. 9 p.m. In bed, completely exhausted. I had forgotten how hideous it is starting a new job. I was late through no fault of my own. It was impossible to get into the TV studios, as I had no pass and the door was run by the sort of security guards who'd think their job is to prevent the staff from entering the building. By the time I'd reached reception, it was 9:25, and the conference was at 9:30. Patchouli eventually appeared to fetch me with 2 huge barking dogs, one of which started jumping up and licking my face, while the other put its head straight up my skirt.
"They're Richards! Aren't they, like, brilliant?" she said. "I'll just take them to the car."
"Won't I be late for the meeting?" I said desperately, holding on to the dog's head between my knees and trying to push it away. By the time I got into the office, therefore, the meeting had started and everyone stared except Richard, whose portly form was clad in a strange green woolen boiler suit.
"Come on, come on,"
he was saying, jigging and beckoning the table towards him with both hands.
"I'm thinking 9 o'clock service. I'm thinking dirty vicars. I'm thinking sexual acts in church. I'm thinking, why do women fall for vicars? Come on, I'm not paying you for nothing. Have an idea."
"Why don't you interview Joanna Trollope?" I said.
"A Trollope?"
he said, staring at me blankly.
"What Trollope?"
"Joanna Trollope. The woman who wrote The Rector's Wife that was on the telly. The Rector's Wife. She should know."
A leery smile spread across his face.
Brilliant,
he said to my breasts.
Absolutely fucking brilliant.
When the meeting was over, I rushed to the loo to recover my composure, where Patchouli was making herself up next to her friend, who was wearing a sprayed-on dress that showed her pants and midriff.
This isn't too tarty, is it?
The girl was saying to Patchouli.
You should have seen those bitch 30-something faces when I walked in. Oh!
Both girls looked at me, horrified, with their hands over their mouths.
We didn't mean you,
they said. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to stand this. Saturday, 9th of September, 8 p.m. Off to dinner party. All the smug marrieds keep inviting me on Saturday night now I'm alone again, seating me opposite an increasingly horrifying selection of single men. Midnight. Oh, dear. Everyone was trying to cheer up the spare man. 37, newly divorced by wife, sample view.
I have to say, I do think Michael Howard is somewhat unfairly maligned.
Don't know what you're complaining about. Jeremy was holding forth to him.
Men get more attractive when they get older, and women get less attractive. So all those 22-year-olds who wouldn't look at you when you were 25 will be gagging for it.
I sat head down, quivering furiously at their inferences of female sell-by dates.
Oh, yes, I quite agree it's much the best to go for younger partners, I burst out airily. These days I'm only really interested in men in their early 20s. They are so much better able to... well, you know.
Really? Said Magda, rather too eagerly.
How?
Yes, you're interested, interjected Jeremy, glaring at Magda. But the point is, they're not interested in you.
Excuse me. My current boyfriend is 23, I said sweetly.
There was a stunned silence.
Well, in that case, said Alex, smirking, you can bring him to us next Saturday when you come to dinner, can't you? Bugger!
Where am I going to find a 23-year-old who will come to dinner with smug marrieds on a Saturday night instead of taking contaminated ecstasy tablets?
Rang Tom to moan about the no 23-year-old date crisis.
What about Gav? He said.
Gav? You know, the guy you met at the Saatchi Gallery.
Do you think he'd mind?
No, he was really into you.
He wasn't. Shut up.
He was. Stop obsessing. Leave it to me.
Tuesday, 19th of September. Blimey, must hurry. About to go on date with Diet Coke young whippersnapper. Gav turned out to be completely divine and behaved exquisitely at Alex's dinner party on Saturday, flirting with all the wives, fawning over me, and fielding all their trick questions over our relationship with the intellectual dexterity of a fellow of all souls. Unfortunately, I was so overcome with gratitude in the taxi on the way back, I was powerless to resist his advances. I did, however, manage to get a grip of myself and not accept his invitation to go in for coffee. Subsequently, however, I felt guilty about being a prick teaser. So when Gav rang and asked me round to his house for dinner tonight, I accepted graciously. Midnight. Feel like old woman of the hills. It was all very sweet and shy to start with. Gav had cooked spag bog. The problem came when food preparation and serving were over and activities turned to conversation. We ended up, for some reason, talking about Princess Diana. It seemed such a fairy tale. I remember sitting on that wall outside St. Paul's at the wedding, I said. Were you there? Gav looked embarrassed.
Actually, I was only 6 at the time.
Eventually we gave up on conversation and Gav, with tremendous excitement, this, I recall, the fabulous thing about 22-year-olds, began to kiss me and simultaneously try to find entrances to my clothes. Eventually he managed to slide his hand over my stomach, at which point he said, it was so humiliating.
You're all squashy. I couldn't go on with it after that. Saturday, 23rd of September, 10 a.m. Right. I'm going to reply to Mark Darcy's invitation and say quite clearly and firmly that I will be unable to attend. Oh, God, though. It is one of those mad invitations written in the third person. Seem to remember from childhood, I'm supposed to reply in same oblique style, as if I am imaginary person employed by self to reply to invitations from imaginary people employed by friends to issue invitations. What to put? Bridget Jones regrets that she will be unable... Miss Bridget Jones is distraught that she will be unable... Devastated does not do justice to the feelings of Miss Bridget Jones. Ooh, telephone. It was Dad. Bridget, my dear, you are coming to the horror event next Saturday, aren't you? The Darcy's Ruby wedding, you mean? What else? I was kind of hoping to get out of it. The line went quiet at the other end. Dad? There was a muffled sob. Dad was crying. I think Dad is having a nervous breakdown. What's wrong, Dad? It's... He broke down again. It's the thought of her going with that greasy, be-perfumed bouffant wop, and all my friends and colleagues of 40 years saying cheers to the pair of them and writing me off as history. They won't. Oh, yes, they will. I'm determined to go, Bridget. I'm going to get on my glad rags and hold my head up high and... But... Sobs again. What? I need some moral support. 11:30 a.m. It is with great pleasure that Miss Bridget Jones accepts... Oh, for God's sake. Dear Mark, thank you for your invitation to your Ruby wedding party for Malcolm and Elaine. I would love to come. Yours, Bridget Jones. Tuesday, 26th of September. It is great when you start thinking about your career instead of worrying about trivial things, men and relationships. It's going really well on Good Afternoon. The really exciting news is that I'm going to be given a tryout in front of the camera. Richard Finch got this idea into his head at the end of last week that he wanted to do a live-action special with reporters attached to emergency services all over the capital. This morning when I arrived, he grabbed me by the shoulders, yelling, "Bridget, we're on! Fire! I want you on camera! I'm thinking miniskirt! I'm thinking fireman's helmet! I'm thinking point in the O's!" Anyway, it is all happening tomorrow, and I have to report to Lewisham Fire Station at 11 o'clock. I'm going to ring round everybody tonight and tell them to watch. Wednesday, 27th of September, 9 p.m. Have never been so humiliated in my life. The idea was that when they cut to Lewisham, I was going to slide down the pole into shot and start interviewing a fireman. At 5 o'clock, as we went on air, I was perched at the top of the pole ready to slide down on my cue. Then suddenly, in my earpiece, I heard Richard shouting, "Go, go, 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 go!" So I let go of the pole and started to slide. Then he continued, "Go, go, go, Newcastle! Bridget, stand by in Lewisham! Coming to you in 30 seconds!" I thought about dropping to the bottom of the pole and rushing back up the stairs, but I was only a few feet down, so I started to pull myself up again instead. Then suddenly there was a great bellow in my ear. "Bridget, we're on you! What the fuck are you doing? You are meant to be sliding down the pole, not climbing up it. Go, go, go!" Hysterically, I grinned at the camera and dropped myself down, landing as scheduled by the feet of the fireman I was supposed to interview. "Lewisham, we're out of time. Wind it up, Bridget!" yelled Richard in my ear. "And now, back to the studio," I said. And that was it. Thursday, 28th of September, 11 a.m. I'm in disgrace and am laughingstock. Richard Finch humiliated me in front of the whole meeting, flinging words like
shambles, disgrace,
and
bleeding bloody idiot
at me randomly. And now back to the studio seems to have turned into a new catchphrase in the office. Patchouli came up and said,
oh, like, don't take any notice of Richard, right? He's, like, you know, really into control, right? That fireman's pole thing was really, like, subversive and brilliant, right? Anyway, like, now back to the studio, okay?
October. Sunday, the 1st of October. 4 a.m. Startling. One of the most startling evenings of life. After got depressed on Friday, Jude came round bringing with her a fantastic black dress for me to borrow for party. Had shock and arrival at the party, as Mark Darcy's house was huge, detached wedding cake style mansion on Holland Park Avenue, where Harold Pinter, they say, lives, surrounded by greenery. At the door we were greeted by serving staff who gave us champagne and relieved us of our gifts. I had brought Malcolm and Elaine a copy of Perry Como's love songs from the year they were married, plus a Body Shop terracotta essential oil burner as an extra present for Elaine, as she had been asking me about essential oils at the turkey curry buffet. Downstairs was one vast room, with a dark wood floor and a conservatory giving on to the garden. The whole room was lit by candles. Dad and I just stood and stared, completely speechless. There were large silver trays containing prawn wontons, tomato and mozzarella tartlets, and chicken satay. It's a sensational party, said my father, helping himself to his 19th canopy.
I agree,
I said through a mouthful of tartlet, as my champagne glass was filled as if from nowhere.
It's bloody fantastic.
Mum was now bearing down on us.
What a lovely house. Haven't you got a nice stole to put over your shoulders, Bridget? Dandruff,
trilled Mum, brushing Dad's back.
Now, darling, why on earth aren't you talking to Mark?
Well, I mumbled. What do you think, Pam? Hissed Una tensely, nodding at the room.
Showy,
whispered Mum, exaggerating her lip movements like Les Dawson.
Exactly what I said,
mouthed Una triumphantly. I glanced around nervously and jumped in fright. There, looking at us, not 3 feet away, was Mark Darcy. He must have heard everything. Dinner was served in the drawing room on the ground floor, and I found myself in the queue on the stairs directly behind Mark Darcy. Hi, I said, hoping to make amends for my mother's rudeness. It's a great party, I said. Thanks for inviting me. He stared at me for a moment. Oh, I didn't, he said. My mother invited you. Anyway, must see to the placement. Very much enjoyed your Lewisham Fire Station report, by the way. And he turned and strode upstairs, dodging between the diners and excusing himself while I reeled. As he reached the top of the stairs, Natasha appeared in a stunning gold satin sheath, grabbing his arm possessively and, in her haste, tripping over one of the candles which spilt red wax on the bottom of her dress.
Fuck,
she said.
Fuck.
Funnily enough, the placement turned out to be rather brilliant. Mum was sitting next to neither Dad nor Julio, but Brian Enderby, who she always likes to flirt with. My dad was pink with pleasure at sitting next to a stunning Shakira Kane lookalike. I was really excited. Maybe I would be sandwiched between two of Mark Darcy's dishy friends, top barristers or Americans from Boston, perhaps. But as I looked for my name on the chart, a familiar voice piped up beside me.
So, how's my little Bridget? Aren't I the lucky one? Look, you're right next to me. Una tells me you split up with your fella. I don't know. When are we going to get you married off?
Well, I hope when we do, I shall be the one to do the deed, said the voice on my other side.
I could do with a new vimper. Apricot silk. Mark had thoughtfully put me between Geoffrey and the gay vicar. Actually, though, once we all got a few drinks down, his conversation was by no means stilted. I was asking the vicar what he thought about the miracle of Indian statues of Ganesh, the elephant god taking in milk. The vicar said the word in ecclesiastical circles was that the miracle was due to the effect on terracotta of a hot summer followed by cold weather. As the meal broke up and people started to make their way downstairs for the dancing, I was thinking about what he said. Overcome with curiosity, I excused myself, discreetly taking a teaspoon and milk jug from the table, and nipped into the room where the presents had been unwrapped and put on display. It took me a while to locate the terracotta oil burner, as it had been shoved near the back. But when I did, I simply poured a little milk onto the teaspoon, tilted it, and held it against the edge of the hole where you put the candle in. I couldn't believe it! The essential oil burner was taking in milk! You could actually see the milk disappearing from the teaspoon. "Oh, my God, it's a miracle!" I exclaimed. How was I to know that was when Mark Darcy would be bloody well walking past? "What are you doing?" he said, standing in the doorway. "The essential oil burner I bought your mother is taking in milk," I muttered sulkily. "Oh, don't be ridiculous," he said, laughing. I put some more milk on the teaspoon, tilted the spoon, and sure enough, the oil burner slowly started to take it in. "You see," I said proudly, "it's a miracle." He was pretty impressed, I can tell you. "You're right," he said softly. "It is a miracle." Just then, Natasha appeared in the doorway. "Oh, hi," she said, seeing me. "Not in your bunny girl outfit today, then." And then gave a little laugh to disguise the bitchy comment as an amusing joke. I paused to think up something very witty and cutting to say, but unfortunately couldn't think of anything. So after a bit of a stupid pause, I said, "Nice to see you again. Bye."